hearing that bill today. We're going to start with House Bill 2542. I don't have a sign-up sheet for that, but I believe we've got a number of people signed up to testify.
Chairman Starr, I'll just say that, with 2542, I've given you a whole packet of information there, but I won't go through it today because we'll wait till there's more members and we'll have this up again on Thursday. But just so everyone knows, there's most of that stuff that you have in front of you, you know, with estimates and things, and there's a new revenue impact statement for the bill, and then I've got details on different components of the bill. Just recognize we'll go through that again on Thursday, but we'll just take public testimony today.
Very good. Thank you, Elizabeth. We're going to have J.L. Wilson and Joe Schweinhart come up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair and member of the committee. J.L. Wilson, representing NFIB. I have 12,000 Oregon employers in my organization. For the record, NFIB strongly supports House Bill 2542. We do support a full reconnect of the Oregon tax code to the federal tax code because we think it's necessary, in our view, to assure that Oregon businesses have every advantage in the marketplace here in Oregon. We think that a full connect is conducive to a positive business-friendly atmosphere in the state. It has traditionally been a competitive advantage for Oregon businesses to have a full reconnect to the federal tax code, and we support it accordingly. The one component that I'd like to draw your attention to that's of particular importance to my small and independent employers is the component that ties the Oregon tax code in with the federal tax code as it relates to health savings accounts. Health savings accounts our new wave of health of paying for health care. It was adopted federally in 2003. It allows an employer to buy a high deductible insurance policy and allows employers and employees to contribute to a health savings account to cover health care costs to meet deductibles. In our view, it is a good way to get employers engaged in purchasing health care and health insurance for their employees. Since we do have a growing problem of uninsurance in the state of Oregon, I think it's incumbent on the legislature and policymakers to do everything possible to encourage employers to purchase health savings accounts and health insurance in general for their employees. To the extent that our health savings account law ties in with the federal law, you will be creating a tax deduction for employees and employers who contribute to an employee's health savings account. We think it will help stem the tide of a growing uninsured here in the state of Oregon. We do consider it the wave of the future, as our membership has indicated a very significant and growing interest in health savings accounts and purchasing these accounts for employees, and we think that it's a very beneficial thing and would be a very positive component if we could incentivize health savings accounts here at a state level. So with that, I'll conclude and pass it to Joe, or if you have questions, I'm happy to answer questions.
Yes, comment and a question. Seems to me, as you've stated, that health savings account may be a wave of the future to provide health coverage for some who are not presently being covered. How do you regard health savings account as their effect on the health insurance market as to keeping down the cost of health care?
Thank you, Vice Chair Starr. I'd answer that question by saying I think the more people that you can get into the health insurance pool in general, you're going to be able to keep your rates down. But I think a function of a health savings account that is unique is that it is a little more market-oriented. It allows consumers to spend their dollars as they see fit. It gives them discretion over who they see and how they spend the dollars that they have in their particular health savings account. I think when people are selective like that, they take in information and make their choices. I don't see how it has any other effect than to maximize utilization. That is to say that people will be very careful in how they utilize their dollars, but they'll utilize their dollars in the way that they see fit. And I think that that will have a very positive impact on health insurance rates. And I think that that's why you see that employers are going to go in this direction as well.
Thank you. Question? Yes, Joe.
Mr. Vice Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Schweinhart, Associated Oregon Industries. We're the oldest and largest business advocacy organization in Oregon with over 22,000 members, of which over 300 are manufacturers, both large and small. AOI supports House Bill 2542 for the permanent reconnect. These tax code changes were adopted by Congress in 2004 as the American Jobs Creation Act. Separating any part of this bill would damage the intent of the bill and damage Oregon business. One aspect of the bill I would like to address is the deduction for income attributed to production. It is important because the deduction will help offset additional tax liability from the ETI exclusion forced by the World Trade Organization. Oregon business needs a level playing field to compete in global markets. My members were rather surprised by anyone that would object to supporting the provision, supporting incentives to reinvest foreign earnings in the U.S. This provision will encourage corporations to repatriate foreign earnings back to the U.S. With all the public discussion about U.S. companies spending capital and sending manufacturing overseas, this provision makes total sense. For Oregon, this could increase our return on manufacturing, according to our members, as much as 20%. Manufacturing has one of the highest multiplier effects in terms of job creation. Every $1 million from manufacturing jobs sales supports 8 jobs in the manufacturing sector and 6 jobs in other sectors, such as construction. Overall, manufacturing employment growth in 2005 is only a slight improvement over last year. The economy seems to be evening out in the end as we head into the second half of 2005. It is clear that this measure will assist the most important aspects of Oregon's economy, that being manufacturing. Finally, in terms of the Medicare prescription drug plans and the health savings accounts, our members want to emphasize that the cost of health care is high in every sector of our economy. Business is struggling with the cost of health care and working diligently to keep benefits for employees. The two health care-related provisions are needed assistance. Our members only wish that the cost of health care be brought under control, as the cost of benefits are getting prohibitive in today's economy. AOI urges your support of these issues, and we appreciate this comment. Now, I've also submitted, for the record, some letters from some of our members. The first one I'd like to address is a letter from Monica Coach. And if you've got a copy of that in front of you on page 2, third paragraph, and I'd like to read that, why this is important for Monica. Monica evaluated relocating production of the Beaver motorhome line to either its Colburg, Oregon, or its Wausau, Indiana location. Both states provided compelling relocation proposals. State income tax rules were a significant factor in our decision. Changes in Oregon's income apportionment rules in 2003 and the current progress on House Bill 2542, which will reconnect Oregon income tax rules with those of the federal level, demonstrate that Oregon is committed to the creation of a favorable business climate for manufacturers. This is very important to manufacturing. Another letter that I've submitted is from Brad George of the Oregon Steel Mills. And I'd like to read the last paragraph of that letter. We know that revenue issues are very important to all Oregonians and that tough choices are being made in Salem all the time. All that we ask is, in this particular case, is that you consider the reconnect and the deduction for manufacturing production activities as an investment in Oregon companies that with the reconnect will have a better opportunity to grow their employment, expand our product lines, profit, and pay more taxes in the state in the future. I also have emails from Haslett Stainless Steel and from Coos Bay Fabrication Machine, Inc., urging their legislators to also support this legislation. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, members of the committee, this is a very important bill to manufacturing. And manufacturing is very important to Oregon, so we urge you to support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Question? Yes, Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I found the Mount Monica Coach letter very informative, particularly this part back here where it talks about that if we pass this, we'll be demonstrating that Oregon is committed to creating a favorable business climate. And last time when we failed to stay connected to the federal changes, I said at that time, and I thought that was a terrible mistake, we would send the reverse message, which I believe we've done. I mean, is there any tracking? Have you folks been able to track and tell us, for some reason, we're having a slow recovery, but we don't seem to be, particularly in areas of manufacturing, which has been a major part of our base, we don't seem to be coming back up as fast as the others. Is there any evidence that our failure to track the federal tax break has hurt us in our recovery?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, at this point, no. I have not seen any. I think you're still seeing a tremendous amount of businesses either not expanding here or relocating elsewhere. There was one in the Business Journal on April 8th, a Southern Oregon chocolate maker was moving out of the state, going to, so I've got it here somewhere, one of the primary reasons was the taxes and utilities here are less in Indiana than in Oregon, and they were moving there. Another one was that the investments here, there wasn't enough venture capital to keep them here, that investors from outside the state came in and moved them to Indiana where they felt more comfortable.
So it's a piece of a whole pattern. In other words, it is the message that I believe we're sending, that we're not open for business, that we're not business friendly, and therefore you kind of reap the consequences of that message. Would you agree with that,
Senator George? Yes, I would agree with it. And even more so, it's not only sending a message to those outside the state, we're sending a message to those inside the state.
Follow-up question?
Yes,
sir. I don't know if you saw the Brainstorm article in which they talked with a bunch of people that were making a decision about moving across the Columbia, you know, and whether it was Port of Calama or just moving into Clark County. But a lot of them, you know, traditional, historic Oregon business making a decision to move that way. And what I'm always afraid of is once a momentum like that begins to build, once that you've demonstrated that that's a good idea, and my business may, you know, the folks in my area may say, you know what, that's where we're looking at. So that's why I think it's so important that we right now send a clear message. Well, put the brakes on that. We really want you to stay in Oregon.
Do you agree? Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator George, yes, I do agree. And I think that momentum has already swung in that direction. And what we need to do is prove that that is not the case, and that, you know, just this is just one piece of such business growth legislation that we need.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jim Cravens.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Craven, representing the American Electronics Association, a national trade association that represents the high-tech industry across the country and here in Oregon. My message to you today is a pretty simple one, that I think Oregon ought to reestablish its longstanding policy of being connected to the federal code. Pretty straightforward. Oregon, for a long time, has had that policy. We worked in 1997 with this committee and the House and the full Senate to establish a so-called permanent rolling reconnect so that taxpayers in Oregon, whether they're individuals or businesses, would have that certainty in their tax planning that they could count on tax code changes, federal definitions of income, and rely upon them when filing their Oregon tax return. We understand that some of the budget pressures last session and concerns about what Congress may or may not do between 03 and 05 led this legislature in 2003 to temporarily disconnect from that longstanding policy. And I want to emphasize temporarily. We didn't throw out the concept of rolling reconnect in the 2003 session. We said we'll take a short hiatus from it, make sure that, in quote-unquote, Congress doesn't give away the store in some way that has, you know, tremendous negative impacts upon Oregon, come back in this legislative session, reevaluate, reset, and return to that longstanding policy. And we really appreciate that even though we disagreed with that policy to temporarily disconnect last session, that this legislature did keep us automatically connected, as you heard yesterday, to issues involving depreciation, amortization, and pension and retirement issues. The most complicated things to, if we disconnected from, that would cause the most trauma, I think, for taxpayers. And while it may be interesting, and you got a little taste of it yesterday on such issues as tax breaks for whaling operations in Alaska and some of those somewhat arcane things that are that Congress has done since we last met, it may be interesting to try to parse all those and selectively pick and choose. We're not really certain that that has a great deal of long-term benefit compared to the benefit of remaining fully reconnected to the federal code. A couple of weeks ago, the House wrapped up after extensive discussions in House Revenue Committee, brought a bill out of committee, 6-3 vote, to reestablish a full reconnect with a couple of very minor exceptions. We had a minority report, had a very vigorous debate on the House floor, lasted a couple hours, I think maybe only surpassed by fluoridation. And ultimately that passed on the House floor 37-23. So now it's before you. Some interests advocated in the House, and no doubt may advocate over here on the Senate side, that we should selectively disconnect from individual provisions of the federal code. In the House side, those provisions impacted Oregon manufacturers and impacted employers who provide prescription drug coverage for their retirees. And we just frankly disagree with that approach. The manufacturing provisions in the American Jobs Creation Act were enacted, as you heard yesterday, as part of a very complex congressional discussion, repealing a part of the tax code that we had been, you know, we lost at in the dispute with the European Union, the so-called ETI provision. And that provision was controversial in that some people argued it encouraged manufacturers to move jobs offshore. That's been repealed. It phases out over the next couple of years and will go away. It was replaced as part of the deal making, as it were, that goes on in legislative processes with a new provision that is an incentive for companies who manufacture and provide jobs in the United States. And we thought that's sort of what people wanted out of the tax code. Oregon is twice as dependent as the average U.S. state on manufacturing jobs as a part of our economy, twice as dependent. And that's part of the reason why we suffered so much in the recent recession. We released AEA a report this week on our industry, state by state, and I was doing the numbers over the weekend. I found that of the 30 largest high-tech states in America, Oregon's number 20, by the way, in terms of employment, of the 30 largest high-tech states in America, Oregon is the most dependent on manufacturing jobs as part of the overall high-tech sector. There are bigger states like California in terms of total manufacturing jobs, but those are offset. They have about 60% of their jobs in software and telecommunications and internet and those kinds of things. But if you look at all the high-tech jobs in Oregon, 50-something percent of those are in the manufacturing side of that sector. And so part of the provision in that you will be talking about in this reconnect is a new provision that helps American manufacturers keep jobs in America, and we think that was a wise decision by Congress. It's also important to note, and I think your staff on Thursday, it sounds like, will actually go through all the numbers, the revenue impacts of this bill. It's important to remember that we selectively disconnected last session. So those issues of pensions and depreciation, those are still automatically connected, and we disconnected from other provisions. And you'll see yesterday you went through that CPA report and they talked about items A, B, and C. You know, A and B are the things that are still automatically connected. C are the issues that are in this bill, the things that we need to pass a bill to connect. And I would encourage you on Thursday when you get those numbers to look at both the front and the back page, to look at the A, B's, which are automatic, and the C's. Because if you net them together, you'll find that fully reconnecting to the federal code generates revenue for the state of Oregon, does not lose revenue. Because those things that we still are automatically connected to, you'll see in the revenue impact statement, are to the plus. Some of the provisions on the optional issues are quite frankly to the minus. But I encourage you to net it all out. Because if we had totally disconnected last session and were being asked today to fully reconnect to everything that had happened since then, this would be a revenue-raising bill and would require a three-fifths vote. So I encourage you to look at those numbers on Thursday, to look at the net total impact of remaining fully reconnected and not just focus on the optional items that are subject to this bill. I think the main issue is this. It's tempting, perhaps, to sort of pick and choose, to go down this list of things that you'll see on Thursday in the numbers and go, wow, that one's a negative. Let's not connect to that. And this one's a positive. Let's connect to that. And play this game as sort of a menu approach of picking and choosing among various federal provisions because some might generate revenue and some might lose revenue. I just don't think that's a worthwhile approach to this process when we've had a longstanding policy of, by and large, connecting fully to the federal code so taxpayers can rely upon that in their planning, can lower their CPA costs in terms of filing amended returns and keeping different sets of books, et cetera. I think that's really the issue here. I think the revenue impact, even if you just look at the impact of this bill, is just a few million dollars. It is not a budget buster in the overall budget balance for the state of Oregon compared to the benefits of remaining fully reconnected. And I think that's bottom line. If you start playing the game of selectively disconnecting, you are proposing a tax increase. That was the debate in the House side. The minority report was a tax increase and would have required a three-fifths vote, according to the ruling of the chair. I just urge you to take a step back and look at this in the big picture and a longstanding policy of Oregon and pass the House passed bill and let's move forward and with certainty for taxpayers and the budget balance and move towards adjournment. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Senator George.
Hey, that adjournment thing sounds like a good idea, but to me, not to fully reconnect sends back to that message again, which I believe will have a significant impact on this economy because we are twice as dependent on manufacturing, Jim. But there is also what I believe, if you took everything that's happening in the legislature right now and you put it in a scale and you see all of these regulatory burdens being placed, you see authority being given over, you know, to Boley for more regulation, particularly of, you know, some of our smaller businesses, which has a tendency to be, you know, to suppress growth. All of those things, when you put them together, you better balance it out relative to how business looks at Oregon and just, you know, decides whether to invest here. And I think if we don't fully reconnect, we send a message that, you know what, we really don't want business here. We're putting burden on business on one side, and we're not giving even the equality of benefit over here under the tax code for them to survive. So I think it's critical that we send that message. As you look at the overall pattern of bills coming through the Senate, am I being a little bit paranoid here relative to my fear that we are sending a message from the legislature that we're not exactly business-friendly? And do you think that this helped put the scale back into balance?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator George, that's quite a loaded question. I just personally, from my agenda and the bill tracking I'm doing, I will say honestly that I don't think the Senate has done anything that we'd perceive as negative as of yet. Hasn't been a Senate floor, a bill that's come out of the Senate that we have opposed on the floor, and so we're still hopeful.
Thanks.
Yes, Senator Krasinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Jim,
I guess I just want to reflect on the statement. You said that 2 years ago, this body, for whatever reason, decided to disconnect on some. And you said that the chair, I'm not sure who, which chair, ruled this time that if there was these disconnects, that it would take a three-fifths vote. I don't remember 2 years ago when there was that disconnect that it required a three-fifths vote. Do you remember?
Mr. Chair, Senator Prozanski, I probably wasn't terribly clear. Disconnect, the vote last session to disconnect did not require a three-fifths vote. I'm looking at your staff. The point I was making about the House debate with the majority-minority report, the revenue impact of the minority report was to the positive would have raised revenue, and by I mean the chair, I mean the speaker, ruling from the dais, said that a affirmative vote on the minority report on the House side would have essentially raised taxes, raised revenue, and would have required a three-fifths vote for passage. This majority report did not require a three-fifths vote and won't require that on the Senate side. Am I making it clear or not?
I heard it, but I mean, I guess one, no one ever challenged the speaker as to her ruling. I mean, I don't know if that.
Well,
I guess I'd like to get more information.
Chairman Starr and Representative Pazansky, it is the ruling legislative council that made that decision.
Okay.
So, I mean, they put on the bill itself, you know, raising revenue needs a three-fifths vote. So that way it came out of council was that it was that. So it wasn't just a decision by the speaker.
Well, that's what I just heard the testimony.
Yeah, I know, but that's not correct. It's legislative council that makes that decision.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pozanski, I was referring to that the question was raised on the floor debate, and the speaker did a ruling, but it wasn't her ruling. It was in line with the advice of legislative council.
One other question, if I could.
Yes.
Based on the situation we find ourselves in this cycle, as we did last cycle, and the inability to pay for the services the citizens of the state say they want through initiative process, as well as the existing services, these few millions that you talk about, that's not really a big deal. How do we make that up to the sense of where we can shore up and pay for the schools, make sure we have the education for those students to fill the jobs that your industry wants?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pozanski, I guess my initial reaction is, I'm still working off an assumption that a bottom line budget number has been agreed upon in the House and Senate leadership, and that we're trying to work out how to allocate the $12.393 billion, not add it. And my assumption is that those revenues exist. I hope they do. And that we're not in the process yet. We may get there, I guess, in the legislative debate, to add beyond those resources to grow the pie, so to speak. So that's, I guess, one of my first assumptions. I think, in direct answer to your question, that I believe if we want to have a debate about additional resources from whatever source, whether it's a fee source, a business source, or whatever, I think a more straight-up debate over that concept is probably better than sort of using the Reconnect bill as a way to do that. That's just my opinion. I think that debate is legitimate about whether that 12.393 is the right number, and I know not everyone agrees it is. And if in this body that number, that pie, is thought that we need to grow it somewhat, I think a straight out conversation over a revenue enhancement is appropriate and certainly can be on the table, as opposed to using the Reconnect bill as sort of a, in a sense, backdoor way to generate revenue rather than a straight-up discussion about whether we ought to do a revenue measure. So,
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Craven.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask the opponents of this measure to hold their seats, and I'm going to recess the hearing on this bill and go to House Bill 2234 to accommodate some people who have to leave. And so we'll recess the hearing on
2542.
On House Bill 2542.
Are we coming back to that?
Yes.
Yeah.
We will come back to that. And I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 2034.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Nazan Malik, Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 2034 comes to you via the House from the Revenue Committee on the other side. And this was also introduced by the state treasurer, and the bill attempts to open the avenue, the road for an innovation on financial management, basically to allow the public funds to be deposited in banks, those are primarily small community banks, in excess of the $100,000 that are required or are allowed to be deposited without collateralization. The $100,000, of course, is the ceiling where the depository insurance, whether the FDIC and other insurance arms do that. This would allow them to deposit in excess of that and at the same time maintain the ability of these funds to be insured by utilizing the relationships with different institutions to utilize their coverage of insurance. So that, in essence, would allow using of those funds within the banks in a lot more flexible way, without posing any additional risk to those public funds. And in that sense, it really doesn't have a revenue impact to it per se, nor does it have a fiscal. And it came from the House with majority support.
Thank you. We have three folks signed up. I'll let you all come up together. Darren and Kilman. Mr. Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury. The Treasurer brings you House Bill 2034 at the request of the local banking community. As Mazin indicated, under current law, any public funds deposits in excess of FDIC insurance have to be collateralized, which means the banks have to pledge assets for the custodian bank to be held in the event that the bank defaults. The Treasurer can attach those assets and work to mitigate the loss to public funds. This means that those securities that are pledged aren't available for the local banks to lend in the community. House Bill 2034 will provide that the deposits in excess of FDIC insurance limits can be fully insured, not have to be collateralized, and all of that money can be worked in the community. I'll let the banking industry experts speak to the mechanics of the bill, but in essence, it allows a large deposit to be made at a local bank, for that deposit to be broken into multiple smaller deposits and placed in institutions around the country. At the same time, a like amount of deposits is brought back to that local bank so that it can be, the benefit of the entire deposit can be worked in the community and it can be fully insured to provide actually additional protection for the public funds depositor from what our collateralization statutes currently provide. Our current statutes provide for 25% collateralization, and this would allow for 100% insurance. It's available for deposits up to $10 million. Recently, it was increased by the FDIC. Previously, it had been $5 million. And I guess that's the extent of my testimony, and I'd be happy to turn it over.
Any questions?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association. With me to my left is Bruce Bryant, the president this year of the Independent Community Banks of Oregon, which is a unit of the Oregon Bankers Association. I want to begin by thanking Darren and Treasurer Edwards for bringing this bill forward. As Darren did say, we were looking at introducing it ourselves when we discovered that Treasurer Edwards was going to go and bring the bill. We decided to drop our bill and and or not drop our bill and support Treasurer Edwards. There was no testimony in opposition on the House side, and I believe this bill is ready to be moved. But I will ask Mr. Bryant to make some comments about the mechanics of the bill, if that's okay.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Bryant. I'm president and CEO of Town Center Bank, a small community bank located in the Clackamas area. I'm also here, though, serving today as a longtime member of the Oregon Bankers Association, and this year serving as the president of the Independent Community Banks of Oregon, as well as I sit on the executive committee for the Oregon Bankers Association. House Bill 2034, introduced by Oregon State Treasurer Randall Edwards, would provide Oregon banks a new tool and greater flexibility in the area of accepting public fund deposits. House Bill 2034 would allow Oregon banks to participate in a nationally recognized program known as the Certificate of Deposit Account Registry Service, or what our trade group calls the CDERS program. The CDERS program was initiated and originally developed by the former comptroller of the currency, who also serves as regulator for the national banks. Other principals of that company include former executives of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or the FDIC. The CDERS program allows for deposits in excess of the Federal Deposit Insurance limit to initially be made in my bank or other Oregon banks, and then basically that deposit is redeposited, the excess amount, into insured certificates of deposits of other banking institutions. They may be around the corner or around the country. In the banking industry, this is a process known as net settlement. I continue to control the terms, the rates, the customer relationship in my local office while providing a fully insured deposit to my customer. Similarly, by participating in the CDERS program, my own bank will also be receiving deposits from other members, providing our small community bank with additional deposits that I can use then to lend into our local area. Passage of House Bill 2034 will provide community banks like mine greater flexibility in competing for and accepting public fund deposits by reducing the amount of paperwork required by the state when taking such deposits. Equally important, the public sector customer will have increased protection of their taxpayer public funds since they will be fully insured up to the CDERS product insurance limit, which is currently $10 million. The CDERS program is now fully operational in over a dozen states around the country, and many more states are working, just like this respective legislature, to enact appropriate legislation. In fact, as a member of the Oregon Bankers Association Executive Committee, we had already approved the CDERS program to put on our include on our own 2005 legislative agenda prior to Treasurer Edwards requesting this legislation himself. We sincerely appreciate the Treasurer's office being so proactive on this issue. Mr. Chairman and committee's members, I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today on behalf of House Bill 2034, and be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you for being accommodating.
Appreciate the testimony. The chair believes this bill is ripe for moving, so I'm going to close the public hearing and open the work session. Close the public hearing, open the work session on House Bill 2034. Would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Brzezinski.
I move House Bill 2034 to the floor with the DPAS recommendation.
Senator Brzezinski has moved House Bill 2034 to the floor with a DPAS recommendation. Any discussion? Any opposition? Hearing none, so ordered. House Bill 2034 is moved to the floor with the DPAS recommendation. Who would like to carry the bill?
I'll take it.
Senator Brzezinski will carry. We will reopen our hearing on House Bill 2542 and call up Lori Wimmer Whalen, Ralph Groner, and Kim Nesbitt. get lost?
I'll go get them.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the Oregon Education Association. It's 43,000 members in community colleges and K-12 public schools throughout Oregon. I'm giving you some written testimony that goes into some of the concerns that we had and expressed on the health side. Ultimately, some of those thoughts found their way into the minority report, which you've heard discussed already this morning by reference. And I'd like to point out for the record that the committee bill that you have before you has a $13 million negative revenue impact to the state in the coming biennium with all elements in it. And our minority report had a $13 million positive side impact, which is why the ruling was that there was a three-fifths requirement, and while we think there's probably a legal argument to argue against Legislative Council's decision about tax expenditure cancellations requiring a three-fifths, at this point in time, that is the ruling. Nevertheless, we believe that there are provisions of this bill that amount to new corporate special interest tax breaks to put on the books with Oregon's 352 existing tax expenditures, and that those deserve your full consideration as separate and distinct policy conversations. We believe that chief among those is what we call QPI, which is the acronym for Qualified Production Activities Income. This is the big new manufacturing tax break that you've heard discussed before. It is one that has already generated much research from tax economists who have a lot of expertise on this issue, and I would argue that the conversation about this being simple and easy and easier to administer deserves some pushback, because that is not the expert universally across this nation with respect to this issue. And I would also point out to you that Republican Governor Mitt Romney suggested to the Massachusetts legislature, and they took him up on it, that they should disconnect from this provision because of its dramatic revenue impact, which only grows in out years. I've given you a lot of information about this. Let me touch on some of the key points. Decoupling from the single largest tax break for corporate America in years will protect the state from a pretty significant revenue loss. This piece alone represents $18 million in the next biennium, $27 million in the biennium after that, and so on. We believe that there are costly and confusing administrative and legal quagmires that have yet to be worked out with respect to defining production activity. This comes directly from those experts to whom I referred earlier. And we believe that decoupling from it is a very straightforward thing. Now, I will point out to you that while it is true that Oregon has a manufacturing community that will benefit from this at the federal level, decoupling does not take away that benefit, and this is primarily a federal issue for encouraging location of businesses from offshore. If that argument is true, getting the federal tax break off of a much more sizable federal return is surely going to be the significance here, whether a state offers or does not offer a duplicate state tax break is a separate and distinct question, and I'd ask you to consider it that way. We also dispute the notion that the QPI should be seen as a swap for the loss of the extraterritorial income exclusion. That's simply an illegal, according to the WTO, it's an illegal tax break, and that's why that had to be canceled at the federal level and would have been canceled at the state level if not for Measure 30's failure. So we believe that the ETI has to go nonetheless, and that's where you end up with the positive revenue side. As for the promise of job creation, we have more than 150 tax cut proposals in this building this session, 12.393 budget deal caps notwithstanding, that are moving in various different committees. And they all promise some level of this, and none of them have demonstrated conclusively that any one of them provides or ensures any such thing. A state-level QPI deduction has no direct relationship on jobs or income within Oregon because there's no guarantee that the income that would be claimed under this would be generated within the state or will have created jobs here. That's because multi-state corporations pay taxes to each state where they operate based on apportionment rules. So a multi-state firm could use the state's QPI deduction to reduce its corporate taxes without having a single production employee in that state. That's an accounting maneuver. There are other simple accounting changes that could make existing production activities appear more profitable rather than increase those activities. Again, this is according to the Center on Budget Policy and Priorities, which is a national think tank on such issues. So we can't establish that there would for sure be any stimulus in Oregon, which is what the argument always is for every tax break. But we do know what the revenue loss is. That's simply a matter of fact, not speculation. And if you've read the Oregonian this morning, you read that Portland School Board just voted to eliminate another 250 teaching positions in the Portland School District alone. I think the cavalier tone of some of the testimony about this being, you know, something you should just go ahead and do without scrutiny really bears, again, a little pushback. It's hard to be cavalier when those kinds of cuts are being made already, and surely more to come given the struggles we're having funding all services at an adequate level. We know that from our research, corporations who make relocation and expansion decisions do so for a whole host of reasons, not the least of which is a strong public education system, pre-K through 16. Which Oregon has always had bragging rights to until recently. Corporations consider a mix of issues, including such infrastructure as schools and roads and so on, as well as labor costs and regulatory processes and proximities to their customer base, a variety of issues. And we've testified before this committee many times about the quotes from some fairly prominent folks, such as a recent Secretary of the Treasury, who said they never make relocation or expansion decisions based on the tax policy of a given state. Finally, our only Fortune 500 company, Nike, is likely not subject to this tax break, or if so, only at a negligible level, according to an economist that we've consulted, Joe Courtwright. And that's because the only creative service that is defined as manufacturing under this QPI exemption is filmmaking, not apparel design. Same would be true for Columbia Sportswear. And whether they support it as an ideological concept or not, the fact remains this is not something that would benefit them. And there are other tax breaks that have recently been granted to the electronics community. I would point out to you, again, Oregonian has reported that there's a very large strategic investment program tax break that has just been awarded to Intel that I think has a whole lot more to do with their investment decisions for their production facilities in Oregon. Another concern of opponents to this connection is that this would be an incentive to for corporations to engage in complicated new accounting schemes, shifting the tax responsibility onto America's family by shifting it off of corporations is never something that we would support. According to an international tax economist who is Oregon-based, her name is Kimberly Clossing, the bill will create compliance and enforcement difficulties as firms will have incentive to characterize as much income as possible as production income. An example of that is that coffee bean roasting is considered a manufacturing activity for the purposes of this corporate tax break. Well, if you're Starbucks, and Starbucks lobbyists were very skilled in this particular bill, you're going to shift the columns of your books as creatively as possible so that the majority of your activity is on the roasting side and not on the barista side of the business. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. We believe that some of the other experts that we've listed in our testimony, you could read for yourself, but there are questions about audits from tax notes, from IRS, from various different folks who've weighed in on this issue. I think you can see this is not as simple as it may have been characterized. But chief for us is the fact that the revenue impact of this tax break to Oregon is going to be so high. And yes, it's balanced off by a removal of the extraterritorial income exclusion, but that is only, I believe, a way of embedding these new tax breaks in a bill that comes off looking like it has only a nominal effect overall. We believe that investing in core services such as public education makes better sense in Oregon's efforts to attract and retain profitable enterprises and to stimulate our economy. In short, we don't think there is a particularly good policy reason to connect to this particular deduction. We ask this committee to amend this bill to decouple from this provision. We similarly believe that both the HSA deduction that you've heard about, the health savings account, and the Medicare tax break as well, which is given for subsidies to corporations for maintaining pre-existing prescription drug benefits, but they get it whether they actually do that or not, are also unsupportable. That latter piece, by the way, is another $9.2 million revenue loss per biennium. So you can see that though there are good provisions of the bill, there are certainly provisions that we think make no policy sense for Oregon to go along with, irrespective of what the feds have done. I like to characterize the things that we'd like to see disconnected as tax breaks for the wealthy and tax breaks for the healthy. And I say that because obviously health savings accounts are a great deal as long as you maintain good health. If you are like my husband, a type 1 diabetic, which is certainly not a self-inflicted wound, you'd be bankrupt if you had only an HSA for your health coverage. Senators, the bill as it comes to you may be simple and easy to administer, but it also is filled with, as you heard yesterday in testimony from the CPAs, filled with goodies. I think that says it all, don't you? We ask you to follow Massachusetts' lead and just say no to the huge special interest giveaways embedded in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, distinguished members of the committee. Yeah, slow down and take a look. Thank you. My name for the record is Ralph Groner for Ask Me. I won't take as much time. I simply want to say that I view myself probably, if I had to put it in a political spectrum, I look at this and I always see business testifying, and I really do care for these people. For the most part. And then you see labor come up here, and it really bothers me, so I'm going to do what some of the books I'm reading are telling me to do. I basically am a fiscally conservative populist. I'm one who currently took my checkbook with some medical illness in my family for my granddaughter, my daughter, everybody moving back. Any grandparent, there probably aren't, they're younger back there. But for the most part, they move in, your costs go up. I had to do some things. I had to get rid of my credit cards. I had to cut them up. I had to make sure that I don't spend money I don't have to pay for what I need to get done. I don't look at this as an intellectual. I think what we've done with tax policy in America is we overly intellectualize it. There are some simple facts that the average citizen looks at their checkbook and says, my God, I'm having problems with my utility bills. I am. I'm having problems with my gas, particularly when I put 35,000 miles a year on my car. And I'm having problems paying for everything as well as trying to take care of a family. But I can tell you the populist side of me says, if we were to go to a vote, and I used to like to do this when I was local government, and I would have done it if I could, but I can't. I would say, okay, voter, do you want to continue these tax breaks and connect to tax policies that have led us, and this is really sad, this isn't Republican-Democrat stuff I'm talking about, into the largest deficit that we have in this country. And when I look and read all the articles I do and I see a Humvee gets a $25,000 tax break and a hybrid is removed, $2,000, and you tell me, and Jim Craven, by the way, is a lot brighter than I am. He says, not a major loss to the state of Oregon, and I'm sitting here fighting so hard that I'm exhausted for some of my funds. I have a little thing for my state police. I need $9 million. Now, we've got a $13 million, according to Lisbeth, this biennium potential loss. And I said, what would $13 million do for my local, my people? My state police would finally have 24-hour coverage on I-5. We currently have none. That has impacts on methamphetamine coming into this state, and I can tell you also, I have 20,000 cases that we're behind on dealing with our test in our labs. That means there are 125 rapists and murderers on the street. So anybody can sit up here in this the lobbies and tell you we have the same problems. They all do. 200 teachers laid off. I just lost another 100 because of Medicaid cuts at OHSU. Add that to another 100 just, a month ago. So it's the same everywhere. But I have a crippled children. I have a child development rehab center that's in all 36 counties dealing with the most troubled disabled children in Oregon that currently aren't funded. That would take the other $4 million. So what I did is took your $13 million cut, and I said, hey, I could use it for the state police and public safety, and I could use that for the child development rehab center that takes care of 3,300 kids in this state that came in wheelchairs in front of Ways and Means. And I think part of the disconnect, and I always get in trouble, so I'm going to be really nice, is that I sit in Ways and Means almost full-time because I have, 20-some budgets. And at the same time, I come to revenue as often as I can. And the disconnect is you don't get the testimony here that Ways and Means gets packed houses and overflow with their problems. So the populist side of me is, okay, we can't get a fee passed in this state. If so, you'll be defeated. Okay, let's just be real. Can't support a tax increase or you're going down. One of my best friends, Vic Backlund, lost last time because he voted Cindy Measure 30 out, and I saw the literature. I mean, you can't vote for anything. So this union has stood up and said in front of almost every committee, we need to improve the economy of the state. And when it came to Senator Morris's capital venture for the universities and $4 million for OHSU, and by the way, I'm kind of proud of that in his bill, because for every dollar you put into OHSU, you get 27 back. That's documented. And they're the only ones who have stepped forward and said, for every dollar you donate to us, here's what we return in jobs and money to the economy. And I have argued all my life that you could put on a one-page sheet, if you're going to grow the economy, business, or whoever, union, tell me where the money went and how it was used, and show me the kinds of things I have to do with my personal budget. In the end, I don't like what's happening in our country at a time, and I don't mean this to be partisan because I do care for you folks. I don't care for the rising debt that we're passing on to my grandchild nationally, and we can't incur a debt, as you know, in Oregon. But to pass on to me tax, I call them breaks. I'm just an old labor guy. That's all I am. I'm older than these folks, and I'm a labor guy. And the fact of the matter is, to pass those on to me and my family in this state, telling me that it'll be good for business, when if you can show me that quite specifically with nothing more than a one-page sheet, how many jobs did you create, what was the nature of the salary, then I frankly will stand up as I did for Senator Morris, and I was alone on that. And I will be there to help industry, be that the timber industry. I testified because on the agriculture, if they worked under 1,200 hours, now we're saying it's a direct tax credit for their salary. I said, why didn't we do that for the timber industry? We should have helped the timber industry. That certainly would have helped the employees in Clackamas County, where I'm from. But the point is, this isn't as complicated as we're all making it sound. I think the complications is that they obfuscate the simple facts. We can't live beyond our means. We can't increase fees. We can't increase taxes. Yes, we do need to grow the economy. I totally support that. But show me, in fact, that you've done that. I don't see that occurring. We don't even have simple requirements. Now, if you do that, you'd see us all supporting more often, and business and labor could work much more cooperatively. But the fact of the matter is, I don't believe we can treat this any different than I do my own budget at home. And I have to take everything into account, and I think that legislators and the citizenry have to take into account tax, I know you love the euphemism, expenditures, I abhor it, I'd rather call it tax breaks for what they are. And the fact of the matter is that I couldn't do this personally, not when I see all of the problems we have in Oregon, and you know them well. Now, if you argue, then you want no to argue. I don't want to argue with you. Well, this will improve the economy, and it's going to put money in to solve my state police, and it's going to help me with all of my agencies, from corrections. We're not going to build our prison now. Some are saying we're not going to do this, we're not going to do that. My DAs, my jail, and those are my staff. Multnomah County, it's closed. Brand new jail, can't even staff it. New fire hall next to my house, can't staff it. Haven't been for 3 years. I think the problems in Oregon are much worse than people are bellying up to the bar. The problem is the disconnect, new testimony, new people come in every year, accountants and the like. They sit here with the best of intentions and they're all honest. They're going to tell you how they see it, but what they don't see is ways and means and all the budgets. They don't see the revenue and they don't see the connect that we see and the hurt and the fact that we've got to balance our budget with every tool we can, including a close scrutiny of tax breaks. That's all I have to say, and I really appreciate this opportunity for one of the senior labor people to come in front of you.
Thank you. That's a mouthful. Senator George.
Thanks. This is for you two. We have Senator Morris, you mentioned Senator Morris, has talked about a structural deficit, that we've created a scenario in which you can't cover these costs. One of the things that we're facing, we just heard the other day, that when you average all of the benefits that we give to our employees, it's over 46% additional benefits that are guaranteed to our employees. I mean, that's a tax expenditure if I ever saw one. And we've heard of different agencies that have their benefit packs are over 62%. So you pay somebody $100, you add $62 more on there. Now there's another tax expenditure that's going out. And we hear the city of Portland, you talk about they can't afford to open the jail, but they also can't fund the deficit that they have relative to the retirement plan for certain members of their, you know, their union staff. When are we going to hear from you folks say, let's step up and be accountable for the benefits that have been demanded by the unions, which have put us into a structural deficit that we can't get out of?
May I comment first? Thank you. Thank you. This is Ralph Groner again. Because you can't speak for state employees, I can. I would like you to know, Senator, and thank you for this opportunity, that my members in Oregon basically have been the secretaries, the janitors, the support staff, who don't have this great big humongous PERS benefit that you keep reading about that we've given management. Pardon me, I'm not here to disparage management, but I want, and the Oregonian, by the way, when they were done with that year-long series on PERS, finally in the last page on the last paragraph said, oh, by the way, this only applied, if I recall, to 10%. So what I'm here to stand up for, now that you've opened, that's why we're friends, you did that to help me, was the fact of the matter is my employees have had salary freezes. If you want to look at the state, they're currently under another salary freeze. My members have had salary freezes on something like six out of the last decade. Their salaries haven't kept up with the private sector, not my members. And the fact is that I don't think we have gouged you at all. We have, in fact, at the state bargaining table said we know you had to have pay freezes. And we went along with that. We're asking for a 2% this year because you've had us so many years where our, I call them lovingly, my little people haven't had a raise. So I don't think we are out of line. And I, by the way, it's not City of Portland Jail. That's Multnomah County Jail. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I'd like to respond to that as well. As you probably know, in the last recession, my members gave back or decided to forego more than $32 million of their salary to work for free to keep the school doors open when this state was balancing its budget off of pretty grim dollar amounts. I also believe that a contract is a contract and a promise is a promise, and I also believe you ought to run government like a business, and one of the cardinal rules of business is that you get what you pay for. And if you want to attract the best and brightest, and incidentally, Oregon is one of only 8 states that requires a master's degree for continuing licensure. And our master's degree teachers are, in fact, the lowest paid of any profession that requires that level of initial education as well as the continuing professional development required of them under law. We can have a conversation about compensation packages, salary, benefits, and so on, but I think that it kind of throws, with all due respect, a red herring into the argument. And the fact of the matter is that the state or individual school districts undertake to pay all their employees, whether unionized or management, the compensation of the going rate for the industry. And that's a huge issue. To change that whole dynamic has its consequences in terms of the quality of the educational product. And so, we can have that conversation, but I really think that it has nothing to do with the fact that we are giving away tax breaks left and right with very little scrutiny in the state over and over again, year after year. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's veer off that road and get back on the topic.
Thank you, Senator. Members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, President of the Oregon AFL-CIO. On House Bill 2542, we don't object to the overwhelming number of provisions in this bill, including the whaling provision and the long list you heard. But we object to two. And we object to them because they are new tax breaks for corporations that need to be scrutinized in terms of the public policy purposes they accomplish, and because they're going to cost about $27.8 million in revenue in the next biennium, which will have a significant impact on your ability to maintain services. There are two categories into which these issues fit. One is changes that will take that are taking effect by virtue of the of what was left of our previous reconnect policy that will take effect unless you disconnect from them. And primarily, those changes are those affecting the new Medicare program and the health savings accounts. In this first category, the law that you are now connecting to and have to disconnect from, the new law passed by the Congress in December of 2003, says that when employers get subsidies from the federal treasury to continue their employer-sponsored Medicare prescription drug programs for retirees, that those subsidies are not taxable. In addition, as you see from Attachment A to our written testimony here, employers are not required to maintain the same level of benefits, of prescription drug benefits for their retirees. We think that's that was a policy choice made by the Congress, which doesn't make sense. When this bill was in its original form, before it went to conference committee in the Congress, it was understood that these subsidies, if they applied, would, first of all, require that employers maintain benefits, and secondly, that they would be taxed, and that was part of the scoring of the bill. Eventually, that came out. We don't think it makes sense to allow employers to take subsidies for retiree medical benefits from the federal government and then reduce those benefits as well. Secondly, we've had some discussion about the health savings accounts. You've heard some favorable testimony on those. We have a lot of concerns, and I've attached probably the thickest portion of our testimony here is Exhibit B, which is our analysis of health savings accounts. But the bottom line is that these accounts, in order to take effect, require a minimum of $1,000 deductible for an individual and $2,000 for a family. In other words, they're tied to the high deductible health plans. And that is significantly more than most people now pay. So it is definitely a mechanism to accelerate cost shifting to employees. Further, there are some aspects of how the health savings accounts were established that we think are not good policy when it comes to healthcare policy. First of all, there's nothing in federal law that guarantees that participants will be entitled to the insurance plan's rates on that first $1,000 or $2,000 of treatment that they're paying for. There's an open question as to whether they'll be out-of-pocket paying as individuals paying higher prices or whether the plans can be designed to require that They pay the insured rate. None of these is a overwhelming problem, but they're the kinds of problems that can be fixed if we say in Oregon we want health savings accounts to qualify for favorable tax treatment if you fix these conditions. It will encourage the right kind of behavior by employers, we believe, and be more beneficial to workers if we set some of these conditions. Another is there's nothing that says preventive care has to be covered as part of the plan as opposed to the $1,000 or $2,000 deductible. Employers can choose to do it either way. We think it makes sense, if we're going to provide tax benefits here, that employers be told we think the preventive care should be part of the basic benefits of the plan. Thirdly, there's no limit on the fees that are going to be charged for your health savings account. You can't run health savings accounts out of your own checkbook. You have to set up accounts similar to IRAs. Those have management fees. There's no control on those fees. Fourthly, there's no mechanism for keeping insurers from hiking their administrative fees on what remains of the insured benefit above the deductible. And in many cases, we're fearful that insurers are going to be trying to maintain their profit margins by adding more administrative costs to the insured benefit above the $1,000 and $2,000. We have recommendations in the memo attached in Attachment B, which could be accomplished by basically putting some conditions on how health savings accounts should be managed in the state of Oregon to be more beneficial to employees and still get the tax break. We're not saying don't apply the tax break to health savings accounts. We're saying do it with a few more conditions to encourage the right kind of accounts. Lastly, as you heard from Lori Wimmer, we also object to the qualified production activities income. This is in a category here which will not take effect unless you take affirmative action to connect to it, unlike the previous ones where you'd have to disconnect. And again, this is a matter of cost. It's a matter of being more rational and selective about what tax policies we choose in Oregon and not blindly following the federal. You can probably find employers who would say they would like to have this benefit, but in every session of this legislature that I've been attending since 1995, you've managed to find and approve new tax breaks for employers, not always with the desired result. And I think it's time to take a little more, apply a little more scrutiny to these kinds of tax breaks to make sure they're going to make sense for Oregon in terms of their impact on the revenue side and what Ralph Groner testified to on the service side, as well as on in terms of their effectiveness in promoting job creation. States are required to operate with a balanced budget. The feds are not. And that means that when you enact new tax breaks, you got to cut them from your budget. You have to cut services somewhere. The feds don't do that. They do deficit spending. I think the states have a lot to teach the feds about fiscal discipline. And I think you can begin by looking carefully at what they're doing, where their tax cuts don't have to translate immediately into service reductions, and be more discriminating in what tax breaks you think are going to make sense for Oregon and those we can afford to have, given their impact on the services we care about, whether it's schools or the state police or human services, which have been, I think, well described by Ralph and Lori. It comes down to this. You can choose to give up $13.5 million more next biennium by blindly following the deficit-creating tax changes that will be forced on you by following the federal changes. Or you can choose to gain $13.8 million by being more discriminating and saying, we'll do all of this except for the QPI, except for the subsidy to employers for providing health benefits, which may not be as good as those who are providing up till now, and with a little more conditions applied to the health savings accounts. And that was basically the essence of the minority report on the House side. We think it's more fiscally responsible. We think it's going to be better for our state if we can maintain services that will attract employers here, namely good schools and safe communities. Even more so than it will be to provide yet another tax break when we already have, by most measures, the lowest business tax burden or the next to lowest of all 11 Western states. So we urge you to look carefully at all of these provisions, be more discriminating, and look at the minority report that members of the House promoted, because there's a big difference between losing $13 million or gaining $13 million and its impact on state services. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. I'm sorry that we lost our committee members, but
we didn't lose the quality, though.
Thank you. Compelling testimony. I appreciate it. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2542. And we're going to set the remaining bills over, because I don't have a committee to work with. And we're going to adjourn Senate Revenue for this Tuesday morning. See you tomorrow, we hope.